You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 178. And with me today, I have two University of Wisconsin graduates in nuclear engineering, one who graduated in 1991 and one who graduated in 1999. Cal Abel is the young guy, and Bob Apthorpe is the 91 grad. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing all right.
Excellent.
All right. So Cal is a, you all have heard Cal before. He's a graduate student at the Georgia Tech University, or Georgia Tech. And Bob is a guy who is part of what I call the nuclear diaspora, the guys that we need to get back into the industry. And Bob, what are you doing these days?
I'm doing accident analysis, a sort of a jack of all trades for somewhat difficult problems in waste management, fire risk, and severe accident work. Everything from PRA work on German plants to fire risk in Sweden, Spain, and the U.S., and helping clean up the Hanford site.
Quite a variety. And the reason I call you part of the nuclear diaspora is, I think that's how you pronounce that word, diaspora. There's a lot of people who were trained in nuclear engineering during the period when the first nuclear age was sort of coming to an end. And many people looked around and said, you know, D&D just doesn't sound very interesting to me. Or maybe, you know, operating the plants until their last breath is just not the kind of thing I want to invest my career in. So you moved to something besides nuclear engineering.
Yeah, it really seemed like there was going to be a limit to the number of people we would need long term. D&D is interesting, but it's at some point, you know, there's only so many people that the industry can absorb as you know, no plants are being built and they're cutting up, you know, perfectly good ones like Trojan. I saw an opportunity in the mid '90s to move over into internet work, and so I, you know, had quote retired from doing safety analysis down in Louisiana, and moved over to Texas and did internet work for about 13 years until I got pulled back into the industry.
So it's quite a different mentality, I guess, between doing nuclear work and doing internet work, at least in terms of how you go about completing a task.
It's really interesting because you go from an environment of that very meticulous and methodical, kind of very risk averse mode of working to sort of a flying by the seat of your pants, very dynamic environment. And I think there's some really, you know, so there's some amazing pros and cons in both. I mean, you obviously don't want to run a nuclear plant the same way that you run, say, a website. But on the other hand, you know, I think, you know, there's a lot of interesting things. So a lot of interesting perspectives you get working in both a very dynamic and a very sort of methodical and somewhat static industry. I think it gives you I think if you realize which industry you're working in, you can kind of pull the best from either one. And it's really, really interesting applying some of the lessons you learn in both to the, you know, the other field.
Yes, and it is, to me, one of the greatest opportunities we have is to go and find people who have gone into other industries, not just the computer industry, but things like manufacturing automobiles and making tires, to name a few of the industries that some of my friends who left nuclear went into, and see if we can bring some of those best practices back to what I think could be the most dynamic industry of the next 50 years, taking advantage of the incredible energy density of uranium and thorium.
What I think is really interesting is just being able to get sort of out of the nuclear industry. And I mean, I guess I don't want to criticize the industry for being kind of insular, because it's not. There's not a lot of crossover between nuclear and, you know, people go into nuclear and stay in nuclear, and if they leave, they generally don't come back. And people who are outside of the nuclear industry generally don't gravitate in. So there is, you know, for better or for worse, this kind of unfortunate, you know, insular nature of the nuclear industry. And I don't think it's intentional. I just think it's, that's just kind of how it goes. I mean, you put a nuclear plant in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, you're not going to just like, oh, I'm going to change a job and go work for the nuclear plant. So I think it's really important to have that kind of, you know, crossover and having worked outside of it and then coming back to it, you know, you also realize, like, you know, we did some things really well in the nuclear industry. I mean, people complain about meetings, but I mean, when I worked at River Bend for a while, I can't tell you in later industry, it's like, you know, walking into a meeting and knowing that nobody had an agenda set and nobody knew what they really wanted out of the meeting, and just we would just waste our time. Whereas, you know, I remember back working in a plant environment, you know, you went in there and they knew what they wanted, and they, you know, sometimes you had the corporate type meetings where you just, you know, it was, you were there to listen to someone else talk, but, you know, it was just really refreshing. You get into a meeting, people know what they want, and they call on you, and you tell other people what you want, and you drive to an end, and, you know, you're over and done in half an hour, and you've actually got something good out of it, rather than, you know, looking to throw a noose over a rafter to end the misery.
I'm sorry, the imagery is there.
I apologize. While I was outside of the industry, I also did improv comedy for about 8 years, so I will come up with the occasional unfortunate and vivid bit of metaphor and imagery.
Well, that's okay. If I can stop laughing, I'll ask you the next question. But because I've been in those meetings, I know exactly what you're talking about.
You can't avoid them. If you avoid them, they'll come and search you out.
Yeah. There are some very refreshing things about the nuclear industry in terms of the kind of people you work with, the search for doing things the right way, the ability to admit if you've made a mistake and have no fear that somebody's going to jump all over you simply because you stand up and admit it. Matter of fact, in a nuclear industry, you get really bad if you don't admit it.
Yeah, you're in more trouble if you try to hide it. I mean, if you fess up immediately, the beatings are much worse. More benign. Yeah. The guy, my supervisor when I was down at River Bend, who shall remain nameless for various and sundry reasons, but I had a great deal of respect for him. And he had said that he could not understand how he kept getting promoted, because he kept saying unfortunate things, like everybody thought something was a good idea, around the table, and it would get to him, and he would say, no, it's a bad idea, and he would explain why, and deflate an entire table full of, you know, senior managers. And it's like, they keep promoting me, and I don't understand why.
You know, sometimes there are people that really like those who will point out when the emperor's kind of bare-ass naked, and it's just the way it is. It's a refreshing thing in the industry. But I'm going to move on to the topic that I really wanted to at least start with, and I guess we moved out of that. Bob and Cal have both expressed a great interest in the application of nuclear heat for things other than just producing electricity. And some of the applications of process heat are pretty fascinating, particularly when you think about the fact that of the 100 or so quadrillion BTUs of energy that the U.S. consumes every year, about a third is for process heat. So, Cal, what are some of the things that you've been thinking of in terms of using that fission heat to replace combustion heat?
The biggest one is using the heat from a nuclear reactor to gasify and then subsequently liquefy coal as for transportation fuel, as the most immediate and pressing need that we have for our country, and I think for the world, but more so for our country. And then there's some other applications that you can immediately take off of that once you have that gasified coal. Is that low BTU gas is very useful. It's the fundamental building block of just about everything, and it's a wonderful reductant. So you can use that in reactions for producing iron directly. You can also use it for a feedstock into producing anhydrous ammonia. So fertilizer, wonderful stuff. But just the few big ones that I have kind of floating around right now.
So Bob, have you been interested in that area of the technology as well?
Yeah, I was really fascinated when I think I had heard one of your recent shows, and Cal was on talking about the process heat application, and especially the thought of divorcing the nuclear side from the application side, like keeping the reactor as a licensed heat producing device, and then just getting rid of all, you know, getting the secondary and power generation side out from under like nuclear regulation, so that, you know, it was much easier to use that for, say, as Cal said, for fossil fuel kind of transformation, coal to petroleum or coal to other feedstock, you know, that kind of use.
Yeah, because one of the things you have to think about if you want to use nuclear process heat is you're going to have a factory or something that is going to be fairly close to the reactor, because it's not easy to move heat from one place to another. So you have to have some way to isolate that the nuclear heat from the various loads.
Right, and you look at something like foundry application, where, you know, I don't know if we're talking about process heat to the, you know, in the temperature range for a foundry, but I mean, if you think of, you know, say, I don't know if the listeners are familiar with things like safety related or non safety related equipment, but this notion that you can't make a foundry and all of the attendant kind of process equipment up to nuclear standards, nor should it be. So you have to find a way to both physically or technologically decouple that from the reactor portion, and also find a way to, in a regulatory way, decouple that as well. And that's, you know, true, you know, for something like, water desalinization plants or any, you know, even electrical generation is sort of the same thing. I mean, turbines, for example, are notoriously fragile and unreliable. You look at the number of like turbine disintegrations or turbine fires there have been. I mean, it's a large and very sensitive rotating piece of machinery, and there's just no way you can make that as safe as you can upstream on the nuclear side. I mean, just by the nature of the piece of equipment.
Yeah, the decoupling is, I think, probably the hardest part of being able to do that with the reactor, because the feedback effects with from reactivity, from changes in the your return coolant temperature are huge, and that's what I'm looking at doing in my PhD thesis, is how to go about physically decoupling that with a large enough time scale so that the operators, that operator action can be completely independent of what that is, effectively by buffering that the cold return coming back into the reactor. And what you're talking about with having heat right next to the plant, that also falls into another area with safety, security. Post 9/11, the security measures at the plants have become fairly onerous and very stringent, and have a very large purview. And if you start imposing those nuclear safety or nuclear security requirements on the process yard, they're not going to be able to have the material throughput to be able to handle any form of economic recovery.
Yeah, certainly, and that's just going to drive the cost up astronomically. I mean, since there was a large hiatus between the last time I worked at the plant and my return to the industry in 2008, just noticing, for domestic plants, the huge increase in perimeter security. I mean, getting into the protected area is probably no worse than it used to be. And by protected area, for people who are not familiar with that term, that's sort of the innermost fence between the plant site and the actual reactor buildings themselves. But I mean, just getting in from my experience recently, within the last 6 months, going through just the plant gate security to like the normal office blocks or warehouses or something, they don't exactly, I haven't seen sniffer dogs, but I mean, having to, drive through and people looking under the car with mirrors and having to show your ID and, all this stuff is crazy. You just can't expect that, you just can't expect a normal industrial facility to maintain profitability with that level of what is essentially security theater. Because it really doesn't really buy you anything there. I mean, that's my opinion.
Yeah, but it looks good.
Oh, we're doing something. somebody said we need to do something, so this is something, and we're doing it.
Of course, to me, the security apparatus has been a real detriment to the ability to help people become more comfortable with nuclear energy in general. I mean, the whole idea that you have to, the more secure stuff that we put up, the more people say, wow, you must really be having to hide something, or people are really worried about, somebody coming in. And I just, it bothers me, because I have no idea what anybody could possibly do. I mean, yes, the protected area, the control room, it's good to have some methods of keeping them out, of keeping people out, but I just can't imagine somebody coming in and thinking they can walk out with a fuel assembly.
Well, their only thing they're going to get doing that is cancer.
And a back strain. The things weigh about, 500 pounds apiece or something?
Ooh, I think they're a little more than that. I think they're pretty close to a ton-ish. I mean, it's 12 feet tall, 17 by 17 tin.
Yeah, They're not small. They're
heavy.
It's made out of something atomically similar to lead. So yeah, it's going to be kind of hefty. But I mean, I'll give you an interesting example. So my parents live not too far from the DC Cook plant, and my mom said that their quilting club used to go to the DC Cook Energy Center because they could get a room there and you know do their you know get their quilting on and you know post 9/11 they kind of had to lock all that down. I'm not certain exactly you know what you're going to do. You know what a terrorist is going to do with an energy center other than steal all those little plastic demonstration pellets they give to fourth graders. But I mean, you know, it's that level of security is really, I mean, it's really driving for a further wedge between, you know, the public and the plant. I mean, ultimately we want to do a good thing and keep the plant secure. And I'm not going to argue about, you know, any of the security that goes into keeping the protected area protected. But, you know, some of this other stuff is just, you know, frankly, you know, it's that post 9/11 paranoia security theater going on. And, you know, nobody is, you know, there's no political hay to be made out of, like, reducing that kind of irritation.
No, as a matter of fact, there's a lot of political hay to be made to increase the cost of nuclear energy because an awful lot of very rich and powerful political contributors don't like nuclear energy especially cheap nuclear energy, because it would reduce the value of their products. But, hey, Cal, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, when you've been doing your research on this kind of ability to buffer the heat, have you been looking at all of the work that the solar thermal technology is done with molten salt and that kind of stuff?
I was actually looking at borrowing directly what they were doing. They have a wonderful salt called solar salt. It's a mixture of potassium nitrate and sodium nitrate, so saltpeter, basically. And it works from 560 degrees Celsius down to about 260 degrees Celsius, which is perfect for the initial round of Gen 4 reactors that are coming out, or fourth generation nuclear reactors that are coming out. They're all kind of around that same temperature range, right around 500 degrees Celsius. So I was actually looking at taking their design and using that directly in my models. It's basically, you have two gigantic thermoses filled with salt, and you have a hot one that's at 560 degrees Celsius, and then you have a cold one that's at 280 degrees Celsius, and you pump the salt from the cold thermos through a heat exchanger. It doesn't really matter what your heat exchanger's got on one side or the other. It could be, you know, a solar tower, or it could be a nuclear reactor. And then you heat up the salt, and then you put it into the hot salt thermos, and then you take it out when you need it.
You know, what I find is really interesting is that, technology-wise, there's really no conflict between, I would hope, between, you know, say the nuclear people and the solar people. You know, we're all in this together. I mean, this is all a matter of you know, transforming and making use of energy. So, I mean, you know, just because, you know, maybe I've attached my, you know, horse to the cart of nuclear for right now, I mean, it has, you know, it's like, I still want to see solar succeed, and I want to, you know, I want to look into those technologies to see, you know, what best I can, you know, leverage, you know, from them. Because, you know, it's, when it comes down to it, we're all engineers, and we're all trying the best we can for whatever we're working on. So, you know, I think, grabbing the solar technology, you know, run with it.
So, Cal, I was going to ask you, what kind of costs have you seen? I mean, is this a cheap salt?
It's 50 cents a kilogram, and it's already pretty well used as a working fluid in industry already. So we've got a good understanding of the chemistry behind it, a good understanding of the metals compatibility especially in those temperature ranges, we've got a good range of material selections that we can use. So it's not really going very far out on a technological limb for being able to adapt it to nuclear applications.
Okay, so help me understand, you know, thinking about this in terms of how do we get the heat from the reactor into the salt? How would you use, instead of a steam generator that has water on one side and primary water on the other, you'd use salt on one side and primary water on the other? Tell me, how do you envision this?
You can't. The problem with we have to get away from water as a coolant, because we can't get the water really hot enough to be able to get it to be used in this application. So water, light water reactors are good up to about 260 degrees Celsius. So our salt is already, the cold range of the salt is right at that temperature. So it's using a reactor example for different designs that are out there. My initial thoughts were with General Electric's S-Prism, super power reactor, innovative small module. Another compatible one would be Lifter, the liquid fueled thorium reactor. You've got the Smarter, the small modular advanced high temperature reactor. Pretty much anything that has salt as a coolant for your primary working fluid, helium as your coolant for your primary working fluid, sodium, lead bismuth.
How about CO2 or nitrogen?
You could do that too. So whatever you have, you just have to have a primary coolant that's in the temperature range that the salt's not going to freeze. So it's something that's if you think about it from, I don't know how useful this analogy would be, but like the internet structure, there's two main protocols for which we communicate, and those are TCP and UDP. That would be like what the salt is. And then you have all the different end user things that go on the end of it. So that would be your process applications. Those would be like your TCP and UDP ports, like 80 or 81 for HTML. And then on the other side of the TCP UDP would be effectively like your computer. So you just have to have a computer that can, you know, generate those protocols to be able to do it from a networking perspective. I don't know how many of your listeners are computer nerds, but if there's one out there.
Yeah, well, there's a few computer nerds on the call, but I understand everything you were saying. I hope that other people did too.
It's trying to make a more of a common architecture so that you can. It's the economy of scale is not in the size; it's in the ability to make it bigger and make it flexible with different heat loads and different process heat demands to create a common architecture for those things to be able to communicate with each other.
Well, to use some great phraseology or concepts from the networking world, there's a notion of you know, vertical or horizontal scaling. Vertical scaling is, let's say you've got a database server or a web server, and you want to make it handle more traffic. You just buy a bigger computer. You still have the one. You just have one that's faster or with more memory or faster networking speeds or something. You just keep building one bigger and bigger and bigger. And that seems to be what we, you know, the kind of scaling that we've seen in the, you know, with nuclear plants. You know, you start out with shipping port with a, you know, I don't remember the electric power rating, but I mean probably somewhere in the, you know, somewhere in that 50 to 200 megawatt electric, and then you're moving up into the 600, 800, 1200, 1400, megawatt electric behemoths. Whereas there's another kind of scaling, which is what we're seeing, I think, in the small modular reactor ideas, where to use the computer analogy, if you want to serve a lot of web traffic, you buy 30 cheap, you know, pizza box servers, and you put them in a rack, and you put them all behind a load balancer, and now you've got you can handle as much traffic. And if you need to scale up, you don't have to buy one bigger box. You just throw some more servers in a rack. And in the same way, you know, if you need more power in a small modular reactor type of site, you know, you got two small modular reactors, you know, throw another two in there, throw another two in later on. And especially if you've got this kind of shared thermal reservoir for a process heat application, you know, as you know, as you need to scale, just, you know, drop in a couple more reactors, and, you know, there's your capacity.
And there's one thing that you talked about earlier with the turbines being very unreliable is, even from looking at the generation availability report that NERC puts out, is that a significant portion of the forced outage rates that nuclear facilities have are directly attributed to the secondary systems. So feed pumps, steam generator water level control, feed control, turbine problems, lube oil problems with the turbines. I mean, you have a whole support system that's there. So what I was borrowing another computer analogy is the idea of a RAID, which is where you have a series of hard drives that you put in parallel, and they share across each of them a portion of the total data, so that if you lose one hard drive, you don't lose all your data. It still keeps on performing. So it's making what I coined as an E-RAID, or an energy RAID, with these small reactor modules, you know, probably around the size of no bigger than maybe 1,000 megawatts thermal. And you put three of those together, you reduce the failure rate of those, because you're not tying those reactors to stay critical because they have to have a turbine that's spinning. They can stay critical as long as they've got the electricity to stay critical. They can stay critical because they can put their decay heat or fission heat into some thermal reservoir. So is increasing the reliability of the reactors and then putting them in parallel with each other, so that you don't have one failure can't take out the entire heat source. It only takes out a third of your heat source.
You know,
type idea.
It occurs to me that this idea not only can be used to decouple the reactor from the heat loads, but it could also be used to make it so the reactors operate in the steady state mode that we like to operate reactors, and you could actually use the storage as a means of being able to respond to peak demands and ramp up your power for, you know, a few hours at a time. When the solar thermal guys talk about storing solar energy so they can respond to load demands at night, one of the challenges that I have for them is, how do you store your power for nighttime if you have a few cloudy days in a row? But when you have reactors that can be productive and be predictable about producing heat, it seems to me that it could be a much more economical storage mode and ability to respond to changes in power demand as well.
It is one of the things, you know, I talked about coal to liquids. I really have a hard spot with burning coal to make electricity, because it's not a very good use of that carbon. We can make a lot more money actually turning that coal into liquids. So the world in my head that I created of saying, you know, the what if, is I said, okay, well, if nuclear takes all the coal off the grid, then those nuclear reactors have to be able to supply power at the same dispatch schedule that those coal plants operate at. And the problem that I came up across with that was that the capital recovery, when you start taking that, you know, very expensive capital asset and reducing its
power output is you're killing its capital recovery. And that has a significant negative impact on the cost of electricity. So part of what I was trying to do with the salt, with the salt storage, was to allow what you were suggesting of having a heat source that you can fill your storage tank back up whenever you need it. But that storage tank has an oversized on capacity on the output where it can load follow. And then the other advantage that you have with that too is because your power conversion from heat to electricity is not coupled to a reactor, is that a load dispatcher can have direct control of that in the remote operating center, you know, that's located 300 or 400 miles away of the turbine to drive the electricity. So they control the frequency and they can control the voltage. So they can do frequency adjusting, voltage adjusting, playing with their power factors, everything that they need to do to be able to fully maintain the stability of the grid and respond to changes in demand for anything. So it would help the grid to be more stable.
But you'd still be able to avoid the questioning the NRC would have of having this remote guy doing anything that would immediately control reactor power, right?
Right, because that their return goes into a giant, you know, the giant cold thermos. So it's all coming back at pretty close to the same temperature and just goes into a thermos and sits there. Then what the operators who control the nuclear reactor have control over is they have control over that pump that pumps that salt from the cold thermos and goes to the reactor. And that's where you have your reactivity control. So all that portion there would be safety grade, but it doesn't matter what's on the other side of the salt, or what the salt's being used for, because it doesn't have that impact. And it can't get too cold because then the salt freezes. And then you...
Go ahead.
It limits the temperature swing that you can have in that cold salt vault. And then if you need to, like say if your salt vault gets too cold, you can artificially load it by taking salt directly from the hot one into the cold one. But, I mean, that gives the control for what can affect the reactivity in the reactor completely to the people who operate the reactor, and it gives control over the heat loads for whoever's using the heat for whatever they're using it for, whether it's chemical processes or for generating electricity, gives them control over their load to them. So it's like a security enclave. Another network analogy for you.
Well, there's two really interesting things that fall out of that, I think. You touched on the major elephant in the room for what's stopping the deployment of nuclear. It's not the safety. It's not anti-nuclear opposition. It's purely financial risk. And to go back to the scaling analogy with computers, you know, a pizza box sort of like web server costs very little compared to the scaling up versus scaling out. That one big computer costs a lot. And it does not linearly scale in cost. It gets more and more expensive the larger you make it. Now, maybe for nuclear, there may be some economy of scale for building the kind of behemoth, 1,400 megawatt electric units. But the important thing is the payback time. You know, if you don't need all of that power, why build a plant that produces all that power, and why put all that money at risk building it? Because a 30% finished nuclear plant does not produce 30% profit or 30% economic return. It produces zero till it's 100% and operating. So if you can, you know, mass produce or factory produce, you know, 1,400 megawatts of electric generation in bite-sized units and install them and let them start paying themselves off, you've done, you know, you've really thrown a wrench into the traditional high-risk, high-capital financing for nuclear units in a good way. The second thing that falls out of this is the, you know, by decoupling the plants from the power generation side, which you really cannot do with light water reactors as we are building them now, even the Gen 3 ones. I mean, you know, boiling water reactor, the turbine is an integral part of the heat rejection system. You can't do 100% load shed, you know, without reducing reactor power. Whereas if you decouple the power generation or the ultimate use of your energy from the reactor side, you know, now you know no matter what happens on you know, downstream with the turbine or process or whatever you're using that heat or energy for, if you can decouple that and get that away from the nuclear, what they will call the nuclear island, you've made your system a lot more reliable. You've made your system a lot safer, and further, you know, now you are in a position where, you know, let's say you've got, you know, 50 cents a kilogram or 50 cents a pound for this potassium nitrate salt, you know, you can afford to, you know, have a warehouse of this stuff lying around. And so you can effectively make as much of a heat sink as you want without the worry of it, like, boiling away. Like, you don't need pumps or you don't need to worry about a drought. You know, if there's an accident or something and you need to reject heat, you know, you don't have to worry about a light water reactor where you do a feed and bleed operation where you're pumping water in and then you run out of clean water and now you're pumping in seawater and, you know, somebody's raiding the vending machines for any kind of fluid they can find. So, you know, vitamin water and Mountain Dew are going in now. You know, you can basically, you know, warm up a bulldozer and, you know, shovel this stuff into your heat sink. And especially, you know, if you're expecting, like, you know, to put six small modular reactors in there, you've got this massive heat sink, which you're going to expand with time as you add more reactors to it. You know, we know that the big concern for accident analysis is the rejection of decay heat, because that's the only thing, there's no way to make, you know, there's no way to change the decay heat curves. I mean, you really get into that sort of Scotty, you know, it's like, I can't change the laws of physics type of aspect of it. So if you can find a way to put a big heat sink there and do that kind of passive heat rejection, you know, you're already, you know, and especially if you get rid of, you know, water, which has this phase change and, you know, building pressurization problem. If you can get rid of water as a, you know, a coolant, you know, or working fluid, you know, you've now, you know, you've reduced all your high pressure piping, all your, you know, a lot of your seismic stuff is not nearly as important. You know, it's just, there's, you get so many benefits for not having a coolant that can change phase at such a low temperature or pressure. You know, I think this is a really interesting, and I think there's some really interesting, not only, you know, economic but also safety ramifications of this, of this using this, you know, having this, you know, thermal reservoir.
So Cal, in your research, are you modeling these? You're trying to figure out how to size these? What kind of things are you doing?
The first thing I did was I looked at electricity load and built a statistical model for that to analyze how big of a salt thermos you need for being able to handle your electricity load, so I could run some economic figures on that. I haven't been able to do that, finish that model because I keep on getting overcome by events like the semester of the qualifying exam that I have to take for my PhD, so I'm studying. So looking at that, and then for the kinetics aspect of it, what I'll be doing this summer is using a program called Relap, and then modeling different initiating casualties and testing to see how the reactor responds, because in this model you basically build your fluid system and then you can put in a computer reactor in there and see what happens to the reactor power when you do all these wonderful initiating events. And then the third part is borrowing a little bit from my Navy experience, and that's how we built the shipboard electrical distribution system, the concept of the ring bus, so that it's more of a, when you put these reactors in parallel, you also, in that nuclear island, you have your own electricity generation for producing electrical power that you need to be able to keep the reactors critical, so that you have a concept of what's called self-sustaining. And a reactor from the Navy world, a reactor that's self-sustaining is a safe reactor. So a critical reactor that's self-sustaining is safe because it's producing the power that it needs to be able to reject its own heat, which on board a ship is an important thing because, you know, you're completely isolated from everybody else. So that was a key safety concept that we had really beaten to our heads. Then it's, you now have steam being able to go to your turbines to keep the ship going forward through the water so you don't sink and turn into a crushed soda can.
Which is always a good thing. I prefer not to sink any more than you need to.
Yes.
Speaking as someone who never served, from what I understand, it's a long walk home.
Yes, it's a very long walk home. So is taking that concept and really making the reactor being critical and self-sustaining completely independent of having off-site power available, and doing that through the ring bus concept. So is basically the third part of my research is how to at least propose initially how to go about doing that to do the benefits for that, and then throwing potentially, if I have time, some statistical analysis on that to say this is what happens to the safety when you do that. But I don't want to get too much into PRA because that really is a Hydra, and you're trying to kill the Hydra. and I don't have that much time, and I'm not Hercules.
All right.
Well, I will say you can have as much fun with the PRA as you can possibly stand.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, this has been terrific fun. We're going to have to come back and revisit this as you progress a little further, but I know you probably have studying to do, and I got to give an admission, I would like to go back and see how the game turns out. There's just a little bit of the game left, I believe.
No, the Packers aren't in it. I'm not concerned about it at all.
You guys, you Wisconsin folks, so what can I say?
Oh, crikey.
Hey, thank you very much, both of you, and we'll be in touch often.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it. I love your show, and I'd love to do a bunch more.
Well, that's good. You know, anytime somebody sends me a tweet and says, I really want to be on a podcast. Okay. Especially somebody who's got improv experience, because that always makes the podcast interesting. All right. Take care, guys.
Thanks.
All right, take care, Ron.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.